two certainties in life: death and taxes. So said Benjamin Franklin, one of the founding fathers of America, in 1789. The full quote is actually this. I beg your pardon, the full quotation. Quote is a verb, quotation is a noun. He said this: "Our new constitution is now established and has an appearance that promises permanency. But in this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes." Daniel Defoe, the author of Robinson Crusoe, actually said the same thing 60 years earlier. We are currently surrounded by politicians of all colours claiming that they can rescue us from one tax or another. Let me tell you this. None of them can do anything at all about death. That is so obvious that not even the loonies would put that in their manifesto. We promise to end death throughout the United Kingdom over the next 5 years of government. Today, we meet the man who can. We watch Jesus deliver us from the biggest enemy we all face, which is death. Let me just remind us, though, where we are in the Bible. You remember Jesus' famous Sermon on the Mount. At the end of that, the crowds were amazed. Jesus taught with such authority. After that comes Matthew chapters 8 and 9, which we've been looking at since January. Matthew wants us to know that Jesus didn't just teach with authority, he acted with authority. He exercised great authority as he called people, men and women, to follow him. Jesus' teaching was impressive, but only because he is impressive. And so we've watched Jesus heal people of various kinds of illness. And we've seen his authority over nature, over evil, and over sin. He has called people to follow him, and they have. He does this even for people whose lives are a mess. And he fully expects people to put him at the center of their lives, to shape their time and their priorities around him. It's been an impressive tableau of scenes, but nothing quite prepares you for what happens next. Jesus, the man who can fix death. Jesus' authority is so complete, he can even tell death where to get off. This is actually two stories intertwined with each other. First, we have a young girl who has just died. Mark tells us in his gospel that she was 12 years old. Verse 18, while Jesus was saying this, a synagogue leader came and knelt before him and said, "My daughter has just died, but come and put your hand on her and she will live." It's your worst nightmare. No parent should lose a child. And I don't doubt this man loved his daughter greatly. He was an important man, a respected figure in the community. He has great authority, but this is one problem he cannot solve himself. But Jesus can. He comes, and he either gets down on his knees before Jesus, or he bows low in great respect. Jesus is a far greater dignitary than he is. "Please come and put your hand on my dead daughter. She will live if you do that." If he's wrong, he's just made a fool of himself for nothing. If he's right, he's about to get his dead daughter back. So off they go. Jesus believes he can help the man. If Jesus is wrong, he's about to make an even bigger fool of himself than this man just did. If Jesus is right, he can give this man the one thing that he needs at this moment. But on the way, we meet the second person to be healed today, a woman who has had some kind of bleeding condition for, wait for it, 12 years. Presumably that means it was incurable. But not for Jesus. She crept up behind him. Now that was taking an enormous risk. Bleeding was not just a medical problem back then. It was a religious one and a social one. In the Old Testament, God wanted to teach his people that we have unclean hearts. Deep inside, we're not the people that God wants us to be. And that means we cannot come to worship God because we're not clean before him. And it messes up our relationships with other people as well. Now, the people had to learn this. So God gave them some visual aids. Certain things would make a person unclean. And if you were in that state, you couldn't go to worship and you had to stay away from other people because if you touched somebody else, they would become unclean too. And the only solution was animal sacrifice. The animal's blood took away the uncleanness and the person could meet with God again and become part of society again. What kinds of things would make you unclean under those customs? Well, remember God wanted to teach you that the problem was your heart. It was deep within you. So it was anything that got your insides coming out on show. At the beginning of chapter 8, we met a man with leprosy. Now that's a condition where you could see right through parts of your skin. You see, your insides become visible. There were a number of other conditions as well, but bleeding was right there with the worst of them. So the one place this woman should not be is a crowded place. Anyone she touches would become unclean as well. And after 12 years, we can assume that most people knew who she was. That's why she was so brave to go into the crowd and to do what she did. Finally, she touched the edge of Jesus' cloak. Verse 22, Jesus turned and saw her. "Take heart, daughter," he said, "your faith has healed you." And the woman was healed at that moment. Healed. The word is literally saved. The woman was saved at that moment. Her bleeding stopped. She was not unclean anymore. She could live a normal life again. She just got her life back after 12 years. It would need a blood sacrifice to make her fully clean again. But although this was a year or two early, if you read on in Matthew's Gospel, Jesus had the blood sacrifice side of things taken care of as well. He would deal with that personally. That's why these two stories belong together so well. Yes, there are the obvious connections. Both were women, one 12, one much older. Both were called daughter. One was the daughter of a local dignitary, while Jesus calls the other one daughter. Both were healed with a touch. But as well as all of that, most wonderfully, Jesus brought both back from the dead. The girl was physically dead, but the woman had no kind of life. No one was allowed to touch her. She had to stay away from places where people gathered. She couldn't worship. It must have felt to her a bit like being in a total isolation ward at the Royal Free Hospital in London, protected from everybody by a bubble of protective plastic. Total isolation until the day Jesus gave her life back. We all know, don't we, there's more to being alive than just having a heart that beats. Certain comas can leave somebody what we call brain dead. They're alive, but they can't do anything. Other times, a terrible accident leaves someone with vastly reduced mobility. Yeah, sometimes people get used to it, and they would even reach the point where they don't mind. But even so, they're not the skiing in spring, popping round your house for a drink person that they used to be. We wouldn't want to demean them as a person, but even so, they've lost something. They're somehow less fully alive than they used to be. Or perhaps we just quote John Lennon. Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away, and now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday came suddenly. In this passage, we watch Jesus' authority over death. But we must not think that Jesus is only interested in making sure that we all have one heart that beats with four chambers and two lungs that breathe. In John chapter 10, Jesus said this, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. Jesus came to give us life. That's life with a capital L. He came to make us fully alive, relating to God, relating rightly to each other, enjoying God's good gifts. Some of that has to wait until Jesus returns, but that's what he came to do for us, to make us alive. On with the story. Finally, we arrive at the leader's home. Funerals today are usually hushed, solemn affairs. People file in quietly, take a seat. At the wake, people talk in low voices. Not in Jesus' day. You had to show you were upset by the amount of noise you made. Professional mourners would be hired to cry noisily. Today, you see, the funeral directors will hire you a limousine. In their day, the funeral directors could hire you people to make a lot of noise crying. And you had to have at least two, or you'd skimped on the occasion. Flute players would play sad tunes to help create the melancholy atmosphere. And into all of that commotion going on comes Jesus. Verse 24, go away, the girl is not dead, but asleep. Back home, the lot of you. The funeral directors will see that you still get paid. Don't worry, but you're not needed here anymore. She's only asleep. She wasn't, of course. She was dead. Don't be in any doubt about that. The family wouldn't have made such a terrible mistake. The mourners did this every day for a living, and they laughed in Jesus' face for failing to diagnose a corpse. Jesus, at this point, only knew what the Father had told him, which was that she was dead. He hadn't seen the girl yet. And Matthew recorded only this one instance of Jesus raising the dead. He thought this was the best example among the many others that he could have picked. No, the girl was dead. But the mourners were not needed, and Jesus called her asleep because Jesus was about to wake her up from the sleep of death. Perhaps you've had the experience of travelling with a friend on a train. You doze off in the sunshine, and as you pull into the station where you are going to get off, you realise that your friend is still asleep. So you shake them gently, and they wake up, and you both get off the train, your friend blinking slightly in the sun. Arguably not the most dramatic story I've ever told, but that's precisely the point, as you will see. By the way, perhaps you've had the experience of travelling on a train without a friend. Let's not go there. Someone I know was woken by the cleaner in the sidings just outside Orpington Station. The point is, it takes Jesus no more effort to bring this girl back from death than it takes you to nudge your friend on the train. That's why not being a dreadfully dramatic story is actually exactly the point. All Jesus had to do was say, come on, up you get. And she did. Verse 25, he went in, took the girl by the hand, and she got up. Easy as that. No more challenging than waking her up from an afternoon nap. In fact, remember she was 12 years old. Now, I've never had a 12-year-old daughter, but friends who have would tell me that it is substantially more difficult than this to wake them from sleep.
You're chuckling because you're not quite there yet. You're chuckling because you've been there.
One day, this girl would die again. She'd get ill. She'd have an accident. She'd die of old age. Jesus had just pulled her back from death the way she went in. She was still mortal. But we know how the story ends, don't we? We know that Jesus would die on a cross only to bring himself back to life. Only he didn't come back from death the way he went in. He came out the other side. Given a glorious new body, never to die again. Jesus raised this girl to life. It shows he can do it. And he whets our appetite for the day when he does it for us and does it so well that we will never die again. Death feels so permanent for us, doesn't it? It's the big farewell where auf Wiedersehen never seems the right thing to say. Here we watch Jesus take death and turn it into sleep. Into something we wake up from. Into something that he has the power to wake us from. The crowds were impressed with the authority of his teaching. We have been impressed with his authority in what he does as well. But this story is the best one yet. Curing Peter's mother-in-law's malaria is one thing. Curing death itself is quite another. Modern medicine has advanced to the stages where many diseases that from Jesus' day were incurable now have a cure. They still have not cracked death. And they never will. But there truly is nothing impossible for Jesus. The question is, how do we respond? Jesus calls us to follow him. Do we say yes or no? In this story, we see some amazing examples of trust in Jesus. The grieving father somehow believes that Jesus can raise his dead daughter. He sheds all dignity to fall at Jesus' feet to articulate what he believes can happen. He risks being laughed at for believing Jesus can do something so amazing. And yet, because he trusts Jesus, he is reunited with the daughter he thought he had lost forever. The bleeding woman somehow believes Jesus will heal her if only she can touch him. She risks the hostility of the crowds. She risks being seen in public, in company that would send her away. She risks Jesus' rebuke for her presumption. And yet, because she trusts Jesus, she gets her life back. Jesus calls us to trust and follow him. He calls us with great authority. Following Jesus may not be the dignified thing to do. We might be laughed at. It might not be the socially acceptable thing to do. But if we follow his call, we are putting our life into the hands of the one who turned death into sleep. The one who came to give us life. Life to the full.